Okay, let's unpack this one. Imagine a company that's, well, pretty much a household name for anyone who's ever had to change a flat tire, maybe get a new battery, or even just figure out what that mysterious check engine light means. They're operating in a massive, I mean, incredibly resilient industry, yet for years they've really been struggling. We're talking about Advance Auto Parts, Inc., or AAP, ticker AAP, and they are right now slap bang in the middle of a colossal, really high stakes transformation. Today, we're diving deep. We're getting into the nitty-gritty of Advance Auto Parts. We've pulled together a stack of analyses, financial reports, strategic overviews, everything you need to really understand what's going on. Our mission here is to figure out not just what AAP does, but why it's been underperforming so badly compared to its rivals, and crucially, what its relatively new leadership team is doing to fundamentally turn the ship around, plus what the road ahead looks like, both for the company itself and, well, the broader automotive aftermarket.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, I think, and what makes this almost a textbook case study, really, is that we're looking at a company basically attempting to replicate the playbooks of its wildly successful competitors. This isn't about some kind of groundbreaking innovation, not at all. It's about disciplined, almost relentless execution of a known logistical and operational strategy. We'll definitely explore the sheer scale of this challenge they're facing and, the significant potential upside if they actually manage to pull it off.
Absolutely. So, whether you're a DIY mechanic tinkering in your garage, maybe a professional installer running a shop, an investor watching the market, or maybe just someone endlessly curious about how these big businesses navigate turbulent times, you're going to get some serious aha moments today, I think. I'm just going to peel back the layers, break down the financial jargon into, plain English, and give you the surprising facts, the context that paints a really crystal clear picture of what's actually going on under the hood at AAP. Okay, first off, let's just establish the baseline. Who exactly is Advance Auto Parts? I mean, many of you listening have likely seen their stores around. They're a prominent North American retailer of automotive aftermarket parts. Think of them as your go-to for pretty much everything your car needs after it leaves the dealership, right? Replacement parts, maintenance items like oil and filters, batteries, accessories, you name it, they probably stock it.
And their core strategy, the very fabric of their business model, is what they call a blended box approach. It's quite key to understanding them. This means they aim to serve two very distinct customer segments, basically from the same physical store network. So on one side, you have the do-it-yourself or DIY consumer that's someone, changing their own oil, replacing a headlight bulb, maybe doing some minor repairs at home. And on the other side, there's the do-it-for-me or DIM segment that's primarily professional mechanics and repair shops. They're trying to cater to both from the same infrastructure, essentially leveraging a single operational setup to capture a broader slice of the market. This dual focus is really central to their identity, but it's also been a source of significant complexity for them.
And you mentioned transformation right at the start. So this isn't just business as usual, is it? We're not talking minor tweaks here.
No, not at all.
They're currently undergoing a major strategic and operational overhaul under a relatively new leadership team, correct? Specifically tasked with fixing this legacy of, well, pretty severe underperformance compared to their rivals.
Exactly. It's a complete pivot in their entire approach.
Yeah.
A ground-up rebuild almost.
Okay, so what actually fills their cash registers day to day? What are they selling the most of?
Well, it's a pretty wide array of products. You've got hard parts for actual repairs, like alternators or brake pads. Then there are the routine maintenance items, oil, filters, fluids, batteries are a big category, and accessories too. These are sold through their retail stores, naturally, but also increasingly through their e-commerce platforms as well. It's a fairly broad offering designed to cover most vehicle needs, really. And they operate under several distinct banners, which adds another layer. The flagship Advance Auto Parts stores, those are the core, right? They represent the majority of their retail presence across the U.S. Then you have the independently owned Carquest stores. Those extend their market reach, particularly in certain geographic areas where maybe the main banner isn't as strong. But here's where it gets interesting. Their portfolio also includes Worldpac and Autopart International. Now, these were acquisitions, and historically they focused almost exclusively on the professional installer market, the DIF side, especially for import vehicles. So these banners gave them a strong foothold in the professional segment for, say, European or Asian cars, but they also introduced significant operational complexity into the mix.
Okay, now this sounds like a truly strategic bombshell. The new management is actually looking to simplify things significantly by exploring the sale of Worldpac and their Canadian business units. Why this kind of radical surgery? What does divesting parts of the business mean for, you know, the listener trying to understand this, and why is it such a big deal?
Well, it's a very deliberate effort to divest what they now consider non-core assets. Plain and simple, it's an explicit acknowledgement, really, that the complexity that came from those past acquisitions eventually became a major operational impediment, a drag on the whole system. Imagine trying to run a high-performance race team, but maybe half your pit crew is focused on a completely different sport, like, I don't know, curling.
Right. Spreading yourself too thin.
Yes.
Exactly. Having too many different banners and specialized businesses meant they were spreading their resources thin, struggling to maintain operational efficiency across all of them. It just came too much. So by streamlining and focusing, the new leadership aims to concentrate resources, capital, management attention, everything, on revitalizing the core U.S. blended box model. This simplification is absolutely crucial for improving their turnaround plan's chances and establishing clearer accountability. It's a loud signal they know they can't be all things to all people right now. They need to focus intensely on what they believe they can fix most effectively and hopefully profitably.
Okay. And speaking of brands, I've got a big one. Die Hard, acquired from Sears a few years back, relaunched it in 2020, and it's reportedly a $1 billion business for them now. How much of a strategic advantage is a brand like Die Hard, really, when you're facing such deep operational issues? Does it move the needle?
Die Hard is undoubtedly a fantastic asset. It's got incredible consumer recognition and trust, especially for batteries, which is a critical category.
Right.
It gives them a premium private label brand, you know, something customers know and ask for. However, while a strong brand helps attract customers, absolutely, it doesn't magically solve fundamental operational problems, things like inefficient supply chains or poor parts availability. You can have the best, most trusted brand in the world, but if the specific battery a mechanic needs isn't on the shelf when they need it now, or if it takes too long to get there, well, that brand loyalty can quickly erode, especially with professionals.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Service trumps brand sometimes.
Absolutely. For pros, time is money. So Die Hard's a powerful tool, yes, but it's not a silver bullet for their deeper issues. And speaking of private label, like all the major aftermarket retailers, they also have a robust strategy here beyond Die Hard with brands like Carquest. This lets them offer a tiered selection often categorized as good, better, and best, hitting different quality and price points. That caters both to DIY consumers, who might be more budget conscious, and the pros, who often need higher durability and reliability for their work and reputation.
Now, Advance Auto Parts has a substantial footprint store-wise, but it's been shifting and shifting rapidly. As of April 2025, they operated 4,285 stores, mostly in the U.S., but also Canada, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. But here's the crucial part. They've just completed an aggressive store optimization program, closing over 700 underperforming locations. Okay, explain this. How is closing over 700 stores? That sounds huge. How is that a good thing? What was the goal behind such a massive consolidation?
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive on the surface, doesn't it? Closing stores to get stronger. But this strategic rationalization, as they call it, aims squarely at increasing market density and competitive strength in their most important regions. Simply put, having fewer but better performing stores clustered in a tighter geographic area allows for a quicker, more efficient service, especially delivery. Those 700 plus stores, they were a significant drag on profitability and, just as importantly, on management attention and resources.
So cutting the dead weight.
Precisely. The company reports that over 75% of their remaining stores are now in markets where they hold a number one or number two position by local store count. This should improve local scale. And critically, the efficiency of parts delivery, especially to those professional customers who prioritize speed above almost everything else. It's really about being strategically present where it matters most, rather than just having a high total count that includes many underperforming, frankly, cash-burning locations.
Okay. Their customer mix, you mentioned, is almost perfectly split, roughly 50-50 between DIY and professional, or DIFM. How does this compare to competitors, and why does that professional segment matter so much in this industry?
Well, it contrasts slightly with, say, O'Reilly Automotive. They had about a 52-48 DIY-DIFM split in 2024, slightly favoring DIY, but still very balanced. But the professional segment of the DIFM side, it's a critical battleground for all these players. Why? Because sales to DIFM customers are generally more resilient during economic downturns. Think about it. Vehicle repairs often aren't discretionary for people who rely on their cars for daily life, for work. They have to get fixed, recession or not.
Right. Less choice involved.
Exactly. These professional customers also tend to buy in higher volumes. They're often less price sensitive when they need a part right now to finish a job. And they demand incredibly fast, reliable service. Delivery speed is key. Historically, AAP's struggles in serving this DIFM segment effectively have been a key driver, maybe the key driver, of its underperformance, which raises that important question we keep coming back to. Can they actually win back these crucial high-volume and more stable professional customers? That's a huge focus of their current turnaround effort.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit now. AAP operates in the automotive aftermarket, an industry many people might not think about every day, but it is absolutely massive. Just how big are we talking globally and maybe more specifically in North America?
Oh, it's truly colossal. The global automotive aftermarket was valued somewhere between $430 billion or $470 billion U.S. dollars in 2024. That's
yeah.
Billion with a B. And it's projected to see modest growth, maybe 3.6% to 3.8% CAGR. That's compound annual growth rate through the early 2030s. So steady growth. The North American market is even more robust, actually. The U.S. light-duty aftermarket alone, just cars and light trucks, was projected at $405 billion in 2024. And it's expected to have a stronger CAGR, maybe 5.8% through 2026. So this is consistently healthy, very large and expanding environment for any company operating within it.
So this implies that the industry itself is growing pretty robustly, which must provide a bit of a tailwind, maybe a cushion, for a company like AAP that's in turnaround mode, right? I mean, a rising tide lifts all boats, even a struggling one.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. This implies that a company doesn't necessarily need to, invent completely new sources of demand to grow. It can achieve growth, theoretically, by simply capturing its fair share of an expanding market, or in AEP's case, by reclaiming the share it lost. For a company like Advance Auto Parts, which is so focused on internal operational improvements and winning back lost share, well, this dynamic provides a significant margin for error, you could say, as it executes its turnaround. The rising tide of industry growth can definitely help lift its performance, provided, and this is the key part, provided it can make even modest operational improvements and, crucially, stop bleeding market share to its competitors.
Makes sense. What actually drives this consistent demand year after year? I've heard the average age of vehicles on the road is a huge factor. Are cars really getting that old these days?
That's spot on. It's one of the biggest drivers. The average age of light vehicles in the U.S. hit yet another record, 12.6 years in 2024, and it's projected to climb even higher to 12.8 years in 2025.
Yeah,
and this is due to a couple of key factors. One, improved manufacturing quality means cars simply last longer than they used to. And two, the rising cost of new cars incentivizes consumers, understandably, to keep their existing vehicles for much longer periods. Older vehicles are typically out of warranty, and predictably, they just need more frequent, more substantial repairs and maintenance as they age. The sweet spot for the industry, generally considered vehicles aged 6 to 14 years now, accounts for over 110 million vehicles on U.S. roads. That's nearly 38% of the entire U.S. fleet.
That's a massive built-in customer base.
Exactly. A massive captive audience for aftermarket parts and services.
And more miles driven equals more wear and tear. Simple as that, right? How's that trend looking after the, the disruptions of the pandemic? Are people hitting the roads as much as they used to?
They certainly are. Vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, in the U.S., fully recovered post-COVID. It reached 3.26 trillion miles in 2023, which actually surpassed pre-pandemic levels. And the monthly data we see continues to show robust driving activity. People are driving. This ensures a steady baseline of repair and maintenance demand, directly translating into the need for parts like tires, brakes, filters, suspension components. The more people drive, the more parts wear out, creating this constant underlying demand for the aftermarket. It's pretty reliable.
Okay, and modern cars are, they're practically computers on wheels these days, aren't they? How does that increasing vehicle complexity affect the aftermarket business? Does it make it harder for the average DIYer, the weekend mechanic?
You're exactly right. That's another major trend. While modern vehicles are in many ways more durable, they're also significantly more complex. We're talking sophisticated electronics, dozens of sensors, complex software systems, all interconnected. This makes many repairs really difficult, if not impossible, for the average DIY consumer. I mean, gone are the days of just swapping out a carburetor in your driveway.
Yeah, I wouldn't know where to start.
Right. Now you're dealing with diagnostic codes, specialized tools, integrated electronic systems. This complexity inevitably drives a greater share of the repair business toward the professional DIFM channel, the repair shops. And this ultimately benefits aftermarket retailers who have strong commercial programs, who can effectively supply these professional repair shops, not just with the specialized parts they need, but also, crucially, with the technical support and information they need. And that's precisely the capability AAP is trying so hard to build and strengthen right now.
Okay, so it's a big market with good tailwinds, but the U.S. aftermarket is dominated by just a few major players. Who are AAP's main rivals in this space? Who are they constantly battling against?
Yeah, the industry is really dominated by three publicly traded giants plus one other major player. You have AutoZone, O'Reilly Automotive, and Advance Auto Parts itself. O'Reilly is often considered, you know, best in class by analysts. They have about 6,483 stores as of mid-2025, known for their really effective dual market strategy and a highly efficient supply chain. They execute extremely well. AutoZone is the largest by store count. They had 7,353 stores as of August 2024. Historically strong with DIY customers, but they've been rapidly and successfully growing their commercial, their DIM business. Then there's Genuine Parts Company, operating primarily through its NAPA Auto Parts banner. NAPA has over 6,000 stores, but many are independent franchises, which gives them broad reach but maybe a slightly different operating model. This raises an important question for AAP. Can they really compete effectively against such formidable, well-established, and frankly, exceptionally efficient players? Players who have essentially perfected this business model over decades.
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? And are there still smaller independent players out there? You know, the local mom-and-pop auto parts stores. Are they still a factor for these big companies to potentially acquire or just outcompete?
Yes, absolutely. Despite the consolidation, the continued existence of many independent stores and smaller regional chains still provides a long-term opportunity for further consolidation. This allows the major chains, the big three or four, to keep gaining market share, either through direct acquisition or simply by outcompeting these smaller, often less efficient operators. They can leverage their superior scale, technology, buying power, and supply chain.
Right.
So this fragmentation means there is still an underlying growth potential for the big players just by taking share from the smaller ones, even beyond the overall market growth.
Now, the elephant in the garage, as they say, the rise of electric vehicles. What kind of threat do battery electric vehicles or BEVs pose to the traditional auto parts business model? This must be a huge long-term concern, right?
It is. It's a significant long-term structural threat, particularly to specific parts of the traditional business. BEVs have fundamentally simpler powertrains, dramatically fewer moving parts compared to traditional internal combustion engine, or ICE, vehicles. Think about it. Over 150 component types found in ICE systems, things like spark plugs, fuel injectors, complex exhaust systems, multi-gear transmissions, fuel pumps, radiators, in the same way they're simply eliminated in BEVs. Gone.
That's a lot of parts not needing replacement.
Exactly. Some estimates even suggest routine maintenance and repair costs for an EV could be up to 60% lower than for a comparable ICE vehicle over its lifetime. So this represents a structural decline in demand for many traditional replacement parts, posing a significant long-term challenge to how the aftermarket currently operates and makes money.
But it can't be all doom and gloom, surely. Are there new opportunities for parts sales and services specifically with EVs? It can't be a complete wipeout for the parts stores.
Precisely. It's definitely a shift, not annihilation. The rise of EVs will absolutely create entirely new revenue streams from unique parts and services. Think about high-voltage battery packs, very expensive, complex components. Electric motors themselves. Sophisticated thermal management systems to keep batteries cool or warm. Power inverters. Onboard and offboard charging equipment. These are entirely new categories for aftermarket retailers to potentially stock, service, and definitely for their technicians and store staff to learn about. Also, some EV components might actually wear out faster. For example, due to the higher vehicle weight from the batteries and the instant torque delivery of electric motors, EV tires could wear out up to 20% faster than those on comparable ICE vehicles.
Ah, so still selling tires, maybe even more often.
Potentially, yes. So it creates new, but sometimes familiar areas of demand alongside the completely new ones.
So how quickly will this shift to EVs really impact companies like Advance Auto Parts? Is it an immediate five-alarm fire threat or something further down the road they need to prepare for?
The consensus is that the transition will be gradual, which provides a relatively long runway for adaptation. That's the crucial part. Consider this. In 2023, EVs constituted less than 1% of total aftermarket product volume. Less than 1%. And remember, the bulk of repair spending, that aftermarket sweet spot, occurs on vehicles 4 years old or more. That's a demographic on them. The current EV population, which is still relatively young, is only just beginning to enter in large numbers. Even with optimistic adoption rates for new EV sales, projections show that traditional ICE and hybrid vehicles will still account for over 90% of the U.S. vehicle park, the total number of vehicles on the road well into 2030.
So plenty of gas cars needing parts for a while yet.
Absolutely. This provides a long runway, maybe 10, 15 years or more, for aftermarket companies to adapt, develop new competencies, train staff, build supply relationships for EV parts, and adjust their supply chains. So the immediate concern for AAP, therefore, is rightly focused on fixing its core ICE business first. That will remain the dominant revenue and profit driver for the foreseeable future. Getting that right is job number one.
Okay, so despite being in this robust, growing industry with favorable long-term trends, Advance Auto Parts' competitive position has been weaker. It led to that underperformance we keep mentioning. Expert, what was their Achilles heel? What were the biggest handicaps that really caused them to fall so far behind their peers?
The most significant disadvantage, without a doubt, has been its deep-seated operational inefficiency. And that shows up most clearly as a stark profitability gap compared to its rivals. For years, AAP lagged its peers, O'Reilly and AutoZone, in key performance metrics, just consistently behind. And this stems from a few core issues: a historically complex and fragmented supply chain, chronic underinvestment in their stores and technology, and also, frankly, poorly integrated acquisitions from the past that added complexity without enough synergy. Just look at the numbers. For example, in 2023, O'Reilly and AutoZone both had operating margins over 19.9%, almost 20 cents on the dollar. Meanwhile, AAP's adjusted operating margin guidance for 2025, their target after starting the turnaround, is just 2.0% to 3.0%.
Wow, that difference is staggering.
It is. It's an enormous fundamental difference in how efficiently they convert sales into actual operating profit. That gap is the core problem.
You mentioned that 800, 900 basis point operating margin gap. That sounds like a chasm. What's the real world impact of that difference for a company trying to grow and compete day to day?
It's absolutely astonishing because it fundamentally dictates what they can and perhaps more importantly, what they can't do. Think of it like this, maybe. AutoZone or O'Reilly are keeping around 20 cents of every dollar they take in after paying for the cost of goods sold and running their operations, rent, staff, utilities, everything. That 20 cents is profit. They can then reinvest in new technology, better stores, faster delivery systems, marketing, or return to shareholders through dividends or buybacks. AAP, on the other hand, based on their current guidance, is barely keeping 3 cents.
3 cents versus 20?
Right. That massive 17 cent difference per dollar means they're essentially playing with one hand tied behind their back. They have a significantly less internally generated capital to invest in the very improvements they desperately need to make to catch up. It's not just a small inefficiency. It's a major structural barrier to growth and, frankly, a powerful incentive for this radical transformation they've undertaken. They had to do something drastic.
And you mentioned their store count and market density earlier. How did that specifically play into their competitive struggles, particularly with those professional customers?
Absolutely critical. With fewer stores overall compared to O'Reilly and AutoZone, AAP historically had lower market density in many key regions. They were more spread out. Now, for professional customers, speed of delivery is paramount. It's often the deciding factor. A denser network simply means inventory is physically closer to your clients, enabling faster delivery times, which is a huge competitive advantage in this game. If a mechanic needs a specific part to finish a repair and get a car off their lift quickly, they will absolutely go to whoever can get it to them fastest, most consistently. Loyalty only goes so far.
Reliability is key.
Exactly. So AAP's recent store closures were specifically aimed at addressing this density issue. By concentrating its footprint, they aim to compete more effectively on density and speed, recognizing that simply having more stores isn't enough. They need them in the right places to effectively serve those crucial, time-sensitive DIFM customers.
Okay, here's where it gets truly pivotal and, frankly, a bit painful to look back on. In 2022, their previous management team made what seems like a critical mistake with their pricing strategy. Can you peel back the layers on that a bit? What was the thinking behind it, and why did it backfire so spectacularly?
Yeah, it's a classic case study in, well, maybe what not to do. Imagine a company desperate to close that massive margin gap we just discussed. They're looking for levers to pull, and they think they've found a silver bullet.
Yeah.
Just raising prices across the board. Seems simple enough, right?
Boost the margins directly.
That's precisely what their previous management tried to do. First, they raised prices for DIY customers, and then, critically, they extended those hikes to their professional customers. What happened next was, well, brutal is probably the right word. This move was incredibly ill-timed. Their competitors, O'Reilly and AutoZone, either held steady on pricing or, in some cases, became even more aggressive to capitalize on AAP's move. This led to a significant loss of sales, volume and market share for AAP, particularly among those price-sensitive professional customers who often have established relationships with multiple suppliers and can switch easily.
They just walked away.
Many did. AAP was forced to dramatically reverse course in early 2023, slashing prices significantly just to try and win back the business they'd lost. While this eventually helped stabilize sales volumes, it absolutely crushed their gross margins even further and required a painful, extended period of trying to rebuild customer trust that had been damaged. It really showed the immense cost of such a major strategic misstep.
Wow. Okay, so all these challenges, the deep inefficiency, the lost market share, this pricing debacle, it all culminated in a crisis, essentially, which then led to a complete overhaul at the top. Who's at the helm now? Who is leading this massive turnaround effort?
It's a completely new executive team, brought in specifically for this task. Shane O'Kelly was appointed CEO in late 2023. He came with a strong operational background. He was quickly followed by Ryan Grimsland as the new Chief Financial Officer, the CFO, in November 2023. And then new appointments for Chief Technology Officer and General Counsel followed in early 2025. This new team moved fast. They quickly diagnosed the fundamental problems, no sugarcoating, and immediately launched this comprehensive transformation plan we're discussing. It was a very clear signal, both internally and to the market, that the company needed a fresh perspective and a decisive, even radical change in direction. Status quo was not an option.
Okay, so what's the core of this new strategy? Can you walk us through the blueprint of this strategic pivot? They're attacking it from a few foundational angles, right? Not just one thing.
Indeed. And the strategy itself is almost an explicit admission that nearly every core operational function was, frankly, broken and required a fundamental overhaul, not just incremental adjustments around the edges. It's anchored on three main pillars, as they've outlined it. First is merchandising excellence. That means improving their costs through more strategic sourcing, getting better deals from suppliers, enhancing their product assortment to ensure better parts availability, having the right part on the shelf, and implementing more effective, data-driven, competitive pricing strategies, getting smarter about price. Second is supply chain modernization. This is huge. It involves building a much more efficient hub-and-spoke distribution model, essentially borrowing a proven blueprint from their successful competitors. More on that shortly. And third is store operations improvement. This focuses on standardizing processes across their network, making sure stores operate consistently well, improving labor productivity within the stores, and enhancing the overall customer experience at the local level for both DIY and DIFM customers. It really is a foundational rather than incremental shift across the entire business.
They're essentially trying to rebuild the operational engine from the ground up.
You mentioned the store closures earlier, over 700. That's a huge, almost violent-sounding move. Why was that specific action so important for this overall turnaround plan?
It was absolutely critical. This was a decisive rationalization, a culling designed to eliminate a significant source of financial drag and, just as importantly, to concentrate their limited resources, capital, management time, talent on the most promising markets where they felt they could actually win. Those underperforming stores weren't just losing money. They were bleeding cash and diverting management attention away from the core issues in stronger markets. They were a distraction.
Right. Focus is key in a turnaround.
Exactly. So, coupled with exploring the sale of those non-core units like Worldpac and the Canadian operations, it's all about streamlining their focus squarely onto fixing the core U.S. blended box retail model. That's the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
By shedding these distractions and underperformers, they can better direct precious capital and talent towards making those foundational changes needed to compete effectively in their primary market. It's really about prioritizing survival and building strength over maintaining a sprawling, inefficient presence.
Okay, now for the really big project, their supply chain overhaul. You mentioned they're essentially copying their rivals here, which is frankly a fascinating strategy in itself.
Yeah.
Tell us more about this hub and spoke model. Why is it considered the gold standard in this industry? What makes it work so well?
Well, AAP's new leadership has been refreshingly openly acknowledging that its legacy supply chain was a core weakness. Perhaps the core weakness. Historically, it was characterized by, get this, 38 disparate distribution centers, or DCs, often acquired through different deals running different systems.
38?
Wow. Yeah, it created massive inefficiencies. Imagine this tangled spider web of warehouses, where maybe no two spoke the same language, different IT systems, different processes. A critical part might bounce between three of them before finally reaching a local store days later. It led to delays, lost inventory, higher transportation costs, and most damagingly, frustrated professional customers who need parts fast.
Nightmare for logistics.
absolute nightmare. So they're remodeling it from the ground up to mirror the hub and spoke systems that have powered AutoZone and O'Reilly's success for years. It's a proven model. The new plan is a multi-year consolidation down from those 38 DCs to just 12 large regional DCs by the end of 2026. A huge simplification. These large DCs will then feed inventory to a network of around 60 market hubs. Now, these are essentially large format stores, bigger than a standard AAP store. And they'll carry a much broader assortment, maybe 75,000 to 85,000 SKUs that's stock-keeping units, or unique products far more than a typical store's 20,000, 25,000. This whole structure is designed to drastically improve inventory availability across the entire network, have parts closer to where they're needed, reduce transportation costs by consolidating shipments, and crucially, enable much faster and more reliable same-day delivery to those vital professional customers. It really suggests that the secret sauce in the auto parts industry is less some unique secret and more a matter of disciplined, consistent execution of a known, efficient logistical model.
And they're backing this massive supply chain physical overhaul up with significant technology investments too, right? It's not just about the building.
Yes, absolutely essential. They're investing heavily in their IT infrastructure, including rolling out a new standardized warehouse management system, or WMS, across their entire network, all the DCs and hubs. This is critical. It helps standardize processes, improve inventory tracking and forecasting accuracy, and ultimately enhance overall efficiency. It ensures that the physical changes to the supply chain are supported by modern, capable technology that can actually manage it effectively. You simply can't have a modern, efficient supply chain running on outdated, fragmented software. The tech has to enable the physical changes.
Okay, so these are massive sweeping changes across the board, stores, supply chain, tech. Are they starting to show any results yet at the customer level? Are there any, you know, green shoots, any early signs of life that this is actually working?
Yes, and that's encouraging because turnarounds this big can take time to show results. There are some tangible early indicators. Historically, as we mentioned, their parts availability, particularly for professionals, was often in the low 90% range, which was simply not competitive.
Yeah.
If 1 in 10 parts isn't there when needed, that's a problem. Through improved inventory management practices and the initial rollout of these new market hubs, they reported that parts availability improved significantly up into the mid-90% range in Q1 of 2025. That's a meaningful jump.
Getting closer to competitors.
Getting closer. And another critical metric, especially for professionals, is time to serve. That's the time from when a mechanic places an order to when the part is actually delivered to their shop. This improved quite dramatically, from over 50 minutes on average in fiscal 2024 down to within their target range of 30 to 40 minutes in Q2 of 2025.
That's a big difference for a busy mechanic.
Huge difference. These are crucial early signals that the operational changes are beginning to yield positive results where it matters most with the customer, and it suggests they might be starting to win back some of that crucial trust from the professional segment, one faster delivery at a time. Still early days, but positive signs.
All right, let's talk dollars and cents. Let's get into the numbers, because this is where the cold, hard truth often hits hardest. How has Advance Auto Parts' top-line growth, their overall revenue, compared to its peers in recent years? Have they been keeping pace?
Well, keeping pace would be generous. In recent years, AAP's top-line growth has been sluggish, to say the least, often lagging significantly behind the industry and its main competitors. For their fiscal year 2024, they actually saw a comparable store sales decline of 0.5%. The stores they owned for over a year actually sold less, on average. Now, Q2 of 2025 showed a marginal comparable store sales increase of just 0.1%, so maybe stabilization, a slight positive tick.
Barely positive.
Barely. But this stands in stark contrast to O'Reilly's 4.1%. and AutoZone's 5.0% comparable store sales increases in their recent comparable quarters. I mean, the numbers aren't just different. They're in completely different zip codes, really. This highlights the significant amount of market share AAP has been ceding to its more efficient rivals, even within a generally growing industry. They've been losing ground.
But the real gap, the truly jaw-dropping difference, seems to be in profitability, right? This is where the numbers become, well, eye-opening, maybe even shocking. Can you give us maybe an analogy for what that 3% operating margin feels like compared to a 20% one for a business?
Yeah, this is the most glaring disparity, absolutely. And it's the core of their financial problem, the nut they have to crack. In Q2 2025, AEP's adjusted gross margin was 43.8%.
Sure.
But compare that to O'Reilly's 51.4% and AutoZone's 52.7%. That's an 800 to 900 basis point gap just on gross profit, the money left after paying for the parts themselves. Huge difference right there.
Before even paying for rent or staff.
Exactly. Then you look at the operating income level after all operating expenses are paid. The difference becomes even more pronounced. AEP's adjusted operating income margin, or AOI, was just 3.0% in that quarter, 3 cents on the dollar. Meanwhile, O'Reilly's was a robust 20.2% and AutoZone's was 19.6%. Think of it like running two identical lemonade stands side by side. One, let's call it AutoZone, is keeping 20 cents profit for every dollar of lemonade sold. The other stand, AEP, is only keeping 3 cents profit for that same dollar of lemonade. That massive 17 cent difference per dollar is where all the problems lie, but also where the massive opportunity for improvement exists if they can execute this turnaround. And importantly, their own long-term goal of reaching 7% AOI by 2027, while ambitious for them from where they are now, is still less than half of what their competitors achieve today. It really underscores just how far they need to go to even approach peer-level profitability.
Okay. And how efficiently are they using their invested money compared to others? Does that show up in metrics like return on invested capital, ROIC?
Absolutely. Return on invested capital, ROIC, is a critical measure in retail, especially capital-intensive retail like this, with stores and inventory. Think of it simply as how much profit a company generates for every dollar of capital, debt, and equity it has tied up in its business. It's a crucial yardstick for operational and financial efficiency. AutoZone consistently generates an after-tax ROIC over 35%, which is phenomenal. It reached 55.4% in 2023. O'Reilly's is often even higher, hitting an incredible 76.3% in 2023. They are just machines at generating cash from their assets.
76%, wow.
It's truly best in class. Now, while specific, directly comparable AEP figures for ROIC aren't always explicitly provided in the same way, third-party financial analysis consistently confirms that they've significantly lagged their peers on this metric for years. It just demonstrates, again, their competitors' superior ability to generate significant cash flow from the assets they employ. It's another clear indicator of AEP's profound historical operational inefficiency.
And cash flow generation itself seems to be a real pain point for Advance Auto Parts currently. It sounds like they're actually burning cash just to keep the lights on and fund all these necessary changes. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And it's a major concern. Effective working capital management is absolutely crucial in this business. And it's been a significant struggle for AAP historically. Industry leaders like O'Reilly and AutoZone often manage to achieve what's called a negative cash conversion cycle. That means they essentially sell their inventory and collect the cash from customers before they even have to pay their suppliers for those goods. It's like getting paid before you have to pay your bills, a fantastic position to be in.
Free financing from suppliers, essentially.
In effect, yes. AAP, however, has historically struggled with this. They've often paid their suppliers faster than they turn their inventory into sales, leading to a constant need for cash to fund operations and inventory. For the first half of fiscal 2025, they reported a negative free cash flow, an outflow of $201 million, meaning they spent $201 million more than they brought in from operations after capital expenditures. And that actually worsened from the outflow in the prior year period. Their own full-year 2025 guidance projects continued free cash flow outflow, expected to be between $25 million and $85 million. This really highlights the significant cash investment required for their strategic initiatives before these initiatives start paying off, and the business can even think about generating positive cash flow, let alone returning significant cash to shareholders. They are funding the turnaround partly by burning cash right now.
Okay, to really hammer home this financial chasm, let's quickly reference that summary table comparing their key financial metrics with AutoZone and O'Reilly for the years 2021 through 2023. The numbers are incredibly stark. For net sales, you see AAP hovering around $11 billion, while AutoZone was already pushing past $17.4 billion, and O'Reilly hit $15.8 billion by 2023. That just shows the scale difference. But the comparable sales growth, as you said, is perhaps even more telling of their struggles. AAP managed only 1.4% growth in 2022, and then went negative 0.2% in 2023. That just pales in comparison to AutoZone's consistent 7.1% and 5.3%, or O'Reilly's really impressive 6.4%, 7.9% in those same years. They were growing strongly while AAP was stagnating or shrinking.
Exactly. And the gross margin tells a similar story. AAP was stuck around the 43-44% mark, while its rivals were consistently operating above 51%. That's a huge structural difference in initial profitability. And then, as we discussed, at the operating margin level, it gets even worse. AAP's 4.7% in 2023 is just dwarfed by AutoZone's 19.9% and O'Reilly's 20.2%. This inevitably leads to a massive disparity in the bottom line, the net income. AAP earned just $259 million in 2023, which sounds like a lot, but it's a mere fraction of AutoZone's $2.5 billion
and O'Reilly's $2.3 billion in net income that year.
Just worlds apart.
Worlds apart. And as you noted, the NA often shown for AAP's ROIC in these comparisons really just underscores the lack of comparable strong performance in that critical efficiency metric, too. It makes it incredibly clear numerically just how far behind they had fallen before this new team stepped in.
Okay. So given these, frankly, quite dire financial realities, how has Advance Auto Parts' approach to capital allocation, you know, deciding where they actually put their money, how has that changed under the new leadership? Where do you prioritize putting your money when you're essentially bleeding it?
Well, the shift has been dramatic and decisive. The previous management's focus, which included significant shareholder returns, has been completely replaced. The absolute top priority now is preserving cash to fund this multi-year turnaround plan. Survival and investment first. For fiscal 2025, for instance, their capital expenditures, or CapEx, are guided to be around $300 million. And that money is specifically earmarked for those critical initiatives. The supply chain consolidation, building the new market hubs, and making much-needed investments in store technology and basic store maintenance that had been neglected. This is a necessary and, frankly, unavoidable pivot. They had to shift from returning cash to shareholders to reinvesting every available dollar back into fixing the core business. Acknowledge the foundational issues must be addressed first, no matter the short-term pain for investors.
And this shift in priorities had some pretty dramatic and likely unwelcome consequences for shareholders at the time, right?
It certainly did. Probably the most significant action, the one that really got the market's attention, was the dramatic reduction of the quarterly dividend back in 2023. They slashed it down to just $0.25 per share. This was a very clear, loud signal to the market about the urgent need for balance sheet preservation and capital retention. They needed the cash internally. Furthermore, they completely suspended their share repurchase program. No more buybacks for now. This contrasts sharply with AutoZone and O'Reilly, where share buybacks are a cornerstone of their capital allocation strategy and a major driver of their earnings per share, or EPS, growth over time. So suspending buybacks really highlights AAP's weaker financial position and underscores the intense cash demands of its turnaround plan. They simply couldn't afford both the turnaround and large shareholder returns simultaneously.
They also took on more debt recently to help fund all this, didn't they? That sounds like adding another layer of risk during a turnaround, especially with negative cash flow.
It is a significant financial risk. You're right to point that out. In July 2025, they completed a large debt offering, raising $1.95 billion in new senior notes. And they also established a new $1.0 billion asset-backed revolving credit facility, basically a large credit line secured by their assets like inventory and receivables. Now, these steps were primarily taken to preserve financial flexibility and refinance some upcoming debt maturities, so it wasn't all just for new spending. However, these moves undeniably increased the company's overall leverage, the amount of debt relative to its equity or earnings, at a time when it's generating negative free cash flow.
That's a precarious position.
It is. It underscores the financial bet they're making. The company is essentially gambling that these operational improvements they're investing in will generate sufficient cash flow in the future to comfortably service this increased debt load and make these investments worthwhile. It's definitely a high-stakes financial move.
So is the era of big acquisitions over for them then? I mean, after shedding assets and focusing so intently on fixing their core, it seems unlikely they'd be out shopping for other companies anytime soon.
Yes, I think that's a very safe assumption, for the medium term at least. The focus has shifted decidedly away from M&A-led growth, which, as we discussed, often created more complexity than value for them in the past. The strategy now is squarely focused on organic improvement, fixing what they have, and potentially further divestitures, like the Worldpac and Canada sales they're exploring. After those significant store closures, they are, however, cautiously returning to modest, highly targeted store growth. The plan for 2025 includes a net addition of 30 new stores and building 10 new market hubs. So it represents a slight shift from a purely defensive shrinking posture to a more offensive but still very carefully scaled one. They're ensuring any new growth is likely to be sustainable and efficient from day one, learning from past mistakes, hopefully.
Okay, so let's look forward. If they can actually pull off this massive, complex transformation, what's the biggest opportunity for Advance Auto Parts? Where's the real upside potential for listeners tracking this story?
The most substantial opportunity for value creation, I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, lies in improving its profitability. Closing that massive gap we discussed, think about it. Their operating margins are currently languishing in the low single digits, maybe 3%. Their main competitors are consistently operating near 20%. That vast chasm represents a huge opportunity just through better execution.
Management's own stated long-term target of achieving a 7% adjusted operating margin by 2027, while still conservative compared to peers, as we noted, would translate into a very significant increase in earnings and cash flow from their current deeply depressed base. This internal improvement, just getting better at running a business they already have and closing that profitability gap, is the absolute central pillar of the investment thesis here.
And if they do get better operationally, if their supply chain speeds up, products are actually on the shelves when needed, does that translate directly into winning back customers, especially those valuable professional ones who left?
You'd certainly expect it to. A direct, tangible result of improved operational execution should absolutely be the recapturing of lost market share. Their past struggles, especially that failed pricing strategy, combined with poor parts availability, led to a well-documented exodus of professional customers who rely on speed and reliability. So as these turnaround initiatives hopefully take hold and we're seeing early positive signs like improved parts availability and faster time to service a billet, they definitely have the opportunity to win back these valuable high-volume customers. A return to sustained positive comparable store sales growth, particularly driven by the professional DIFM segment, would be the clearest indicator that this is actually happening. That's a key metric to watch.
What about the long-term impact of EVs? We talked about the long runway, but can they really adapt to that huge structural shift while also trying to fix their core ICE business right now? Seems like a lot to juggle.
It is a lot to juggle, you're right. And like everyone else in the aftermarket, they must prepare for the eventual rise of EVs. There's no avoiding it long-term. This means doing things like establishing new supplier relationships for EV-specific components, investing in employee training for handling high-voltage systems safely and effectively, adapting their inventory management and store layouts over time. But, and this is crucial, in the near to medium term, their focus is rightly, maybe necessarily, on fixing their core internal combustion engine, ICE business first. Why? Because the success of this current turnaround is essentially a prerequisite for having the resources and stability needed for future success in the EV era. Only with improved operational excellence and restored financial stability can they realistically make the necessary long-term investment to adapt to the EV transition without collapsing under the weight of trying to do both simultaneously from a position of weakness. Fix the core first, then pivot.
Ultimately, listening to all this, it really sounds like this whole thing boils down to one key factor: whether this new leadership team can actually execute this massive, complex plan. I mean, the strategy seems sound, borrowed even, but execution is everything, isn't it?
Precisely. You've hit the nail on the head. The strategy itself, primarily imitating the successful hub-and-spoke supply chain model of their peers, focusing on operational basics, is sound. It's well understood. It's not rocket science, conceptually. The immense challenge lies in implementing such a large-scale, deeply disruptive transformation within a company that has, let's be frank, a long and documented history of operational missteps and integration failures. Those early signs we mentioned are encouraging, yes. But the path to achieving those long-term financial targets, like that 7% operating margin, is long, it's multi-year, and it is absolutely fraught with execution risk at every step. Management's ability to navigate this complexity, manage the change effectively, and maintain momentum will be the ultimate determinant of success or failure. It really all comes down to execution.
But no turnaround journey is a smooth, straight road. Expert, what are the biggest risks you'd highlight for someone watching this unfold? What are the potential potholes or roadblocks that could derail this whole effort? What keeps this management team up at night?
Well, the most significant risk, the immediate and constant threat, is that very operational and execution risk we just discussed. It bears repeating. This is a multi-year overhaul impacting nearly every single aspect of the business. Supply chain, stores, IT, merchandising, pricing, people. Everything. Any significant failure to manage this complex transition effectively could lead to further disruptions, missed cost savings targets, delays, and ultimately an inability to close that crucial performance gap with peers. The entire investment thesis hinges on management's ability to execute this plan relatively flawlessly. Secondly, competitive threats remain very real and intense. They are competing head-to-head against two of the most formidable, best-run retailers, not just in auto parts, but arguably in any retail sector, AutoZone and O'Reilly. These companies have significant scale advantages, strong cultures, efficient operations, and deep pockets. They will likely respond aggressively to any gains AAP tries to make, defending their own market share fiercely.
They will just roll over.
Not a chance. Even if AAP improves significantly, their competitors might improve just as fast or faster, preventing AAP from meaningfully closing that relative performance gap. It's a moving target. And as you rightly noted earlier, the financial risk associated with a turnaround is substantial. They've taken on significant additional debt, increasing their leverage precisely at a time when they're burning cash.
negative free cash flow. If the turnaround stalls for any reason, or if the broader economy takes a significant downturn, their ability to service that increased debt load and continue funding the necessary capital expenditures could be severely compromised.
A potential debt spiral.
It's a risk. A failure to return to generating positive, sustainable free cash flow is critical, not just for the turnaround success, but potentially for their long-term viability. Furthermore, while the aftermarket industry is generally resilient, it's not completely immune to macroeconomic pressures. A severe economic downturn could reduce vehicle miles traveled, dampen consumer spending, and put pressure on professional shops, making the turnaround much harder to achieve. Inflation also continues to impact their costs and their customer spending power. And of course, looming in the background is that long-term technological disruption from EVs. It remains an existential threat down the road. A financially weak AAP, even if it survives a current turnaround, may simply not have the resources or the strategic bandwidth to adapt effectively to that fundamental structural change over the next decade or so. Finally, don't forget the internal control and talent risk. The company's disclosure back in 2023 of a material weakness in its internal financial controls, which they linked partly to high turnover among accounting personnel, highlights an ongoing risk.
Right. Having the right people is key.
Absolutely. Attracting, and just as importantly, retaining the high-caliber talent needed across all functions, operations, finance, IT, merchandising, to execute this complex transformation is crucial. Continued instability or difficulty in attracting top people could seriously undermine the plan's execution.
Okay, so turning to valuation, looking at how the market values Advance Auto Parts right now compared to its peers. Well, it sounds like the market isn't exactly showering them with love or confidence at the moment, is it?
No, not at all. And the current valuation really reflects two competing narratives, a story of distress versus potential. On one hand, their current financial performance is undeniably poor, as we've detailed, so its trailing valuation metrics reflect significant distress and investor skepticism. The market sees the current problems clearly. But on the other hand, if this turnaround succeeds, if they can execute, its normalized earnings power in a few years could be substantially higher than it is today. This suggests potential undervaluation relative to its long-term potential if things go right. So traditional valuation metrics based on current deeply depressed earnings are probably less useful right now than a forward-looking assessment of the turnaround's probability of success. Historically, AAP has always traded at some discount to its higher performing peers, but that discount has widened into a massive chasm due to its recent struggles.
Can you give us a couple of specific examples, maybe using common valuation multiples, to highlight that chasm? Just how stark is the difference in how the market sees them versus O'Reilly and AutoZone right now?
Sure. Let's look at enterprise value to sales, or EV sales. This basically tells us how much the market values the entire company, its market cap plus debt, minus cash for every dollar of its annual revenue. It's less sensitive to temporary profit swings. Based on recent data, AAP's EV sales multiple is approximately 0.7x. So the market values the whole company at less than 1 year's worth of sales. Compare that to AutoZone at around 4.0x EV sales and O'Reilly at around 5.3x EV sales.
Wow, 0.7 versus 4.5, that's huge.
It's a massive difference. It reflects the significant premium the market places on the superior profitability and cash flow generation that its competitors derive from each dollar of sales. They do more with less. Now, if you look at EV to EBITDA enterprise value to earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, proxy for cash flow AAP's LTM, last 12 months multiple, was recently around 23.6x. Now, that number actually looks high, maybe even higher than O'Reilly's 25.2x or AutoZone's 18.5x. But it's misleadingly high simply because AAP's current EBITDA, the denominator in that ratio, is so severely depressed. A small denominator makes the ratio look big.
Ah, okay, so it's not a sign of strength.
Not at all. It's a sign of extremely low current earnings. The market simply isn't giving AAP much, if any, credit today for earnings it isn't actually generating yet.
And if we quickly glance at Table 2, valuation multiples comparing AAP to its competitors as of mid-2025, the picture is indeed stark. AAP's market cap is sitting around $3.5 billion. That's tiny compared to AutoZone's $69.1 billion and O'Reilly's $87.9 billion. They're in a different league financially. The enterprise value, which includes debt, similarly shows AAP at $6.1 billion versus $76.1 billion for AutoZone and a whopping $95.1 billion for O'Reilly. This translates directly to that huge EV sales gap we just mentioned, 0.7x for AAP versus 4.0x and 5.3x for the others. And crucially, as you pointed out, you often see NA for AAP's price-to-earnings PE ratio simply because it currently has negative earnings, a net loss. That makes direct PE comparison impossible and starkly underscores its current financial distress. The market is clearly pricing in the current struggles and the significant execution risk ahead.
Exactly. So the investment case for AAP, if one were to make it, isn't really that it's cheap based on its current depressed earnings. It's not. The argument, the bull case, is that it's potentially cheap relative to what it could earn in, say, 2027 or 2028 if the transformation is successful and margins improve significantly. That bull case rests entirely on the market, eventually re-rating the stock, giving it higher multiples as tangible progress is demonstrated quarter after quarter. The bear case, of course, is that execution falters, the turnaround stalls, and it becomes a classy value trap, looks cheap, but never recovers. So valuation for AAP right now is inextricably linked to judging the probability and pace of operational progress. It's all about the turnaround story.
Okay, so if we, the listeners, wanted to keep a close eye on Advance Auto Parts and track this fascinating story as it unfolds over the next few years, what are the absolute most important things to watch? What are the vital signs that would signal success or continued struggle?
Yeah, there are a few core key performance indicators, or KPIs, that you should absolutely track if you're following this. First and foremost is comparable store sales growth. Is it turning positive consistently? Is it accelerating? And critically, look at the breakdown. Is growth being driven by that crucial professional DIM segment? That tells you if they're winning back those key customers. Second, watch that adjusted operating income, AOI margin. Is it showing consistent sequential expansion quarter after quarter? Are they making progress towards that 7% goal, even if it's slow? That's key to closing the profitability chasm. Third, keep an eye on inventory metrics like inventory turnover and days inventory outstanding, DIO. These are crucial indicators of supply chain efficiency. Are they getting parts in and selling them faster? Is the new system working? And finally, absolutely critical, watch free cash flow, FCF. Look for that crucial inflection point where it turns from outflow, burning cash, to sustained inflow, generating cash. That will be a major signal that the business is stabilizing and can finally fund itself and start thinking about debt reduction or shareholder returns down the line.
And we should always be comparing them to their rivals, right? I mean, looking at AAP in a vacuum doesn't tell the whole story. That context seems vital.
Yes, absolutely vital. Constant benchmarking against AutoZone and O'Reilly is critical for providing true context. Don't just look at AAP's numbers in isolation. Ask, is AAP closing the growth gap in comparable sales relative to its peers? Is its margin expansion actually outpacing its peers, meaning the gap is narrowing, or are the peers improving just as fast? Over the longer term, is its ROIC starting to climb and narrow the gap with the leaders? These comparisons will provide the most meaningful context for judging their actual progress. Are they just improving, or are they actually catching up? Big difference.
And what about specific strategic projects or milestones? Are there concrete things we should monitor as tangible signs of progress on the turnaround plan itself?
Yes, definitely track management's commentary and reported progress on a few key strategic milestones. Watch updates on the supply chain consolidation. How many of those old DCs have been closed or consolidated? How is the build-out progressing towards the target of 12 large regional facilities by the end of 2026? Are they hitting their timelines? Keep an eye on the pace of the market hub rollout. How many of the planned 60 hubs are operational? Are they on track to hit the mid-2027 target? Are these hubs delivering the expected sales lift and availability improvements? And of course, look for any definitive announcements regarding potential asset divestitures, specifically the sale of Worldpac or the Canadian Business Unit. If those happen, what are the terms? How will the proceeds be used? That would be a major step in their simplification strategy. Each of these is a foundational piece of their larger turnaround puzzle, and tracking their progress provides tangible evidence of execution. #tag outro entre now.
So wrapping this all up, what does this deep dive really mean for you, our listener? We've seen that Advance Auto Parts is a company in a truly fascinating, undeniably crucial, and exceptionally challenging turnaround situation. They've got a clear strategy now, largely borrowed from successful peers. They have a completely new leadership team driving it. And we are seeing some early positive signs that they're making progress on critical operational fronts like availability and delivery times. But let's be clear, they are playing catch up in a big way to some very strong, very well-run competitors. This story isn't just about auto parts. It's a really compelling case study in the grit and difficulty of large-scale corporate transformation against incredible odds, where disciplined execution truly is everything.
And digging into this case really raises an important, maybe broader question for you, the listener, to think about. In an industry like the automotive aftermarket, which is clearly supported by powerful, favorable long-term trends like aging vehicles and increasing complexity, what's ultimately more impactful for a specific company's success? Is it just being in the right industry at the right time? Or is it executing the right strategy flawlessly, day in and day out, especially when that strategy is essentially a known playbook already mastered by your toughest competitors? Where does the balance lie?
That's definitely a lot to mull over. We certainly hope this deep dive into the intricacies of Advance Auto Parts has given you a valuable shortcut to being well-informed about a major company truly standing at a crossroads. Until next time on The Deep Dive, keep those wheels turning and, as always, keep that curiosity humming.